Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. When she was in college, Caroline Stein went on a haunted hayride with a bunch of her friends.
Waiting in line, they had the fake chainsaws, which scared the heck out of me. And just, you know they're not going to hurt you, but they're still very unnerving.
She was already pretty freaked out. And then as the hayride moved along, they passed a staged funeral scene complete with a coffin.
And one of the ghouls grabbed one of my friends and started putting her in the coffin.
Something snapped in Caroline's head. This felt like a real threat. She charged the ghoul.
Another girl and I just lost our minds and started beating him.
Like with your fist?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were hitting him and screaming and
pounding this guy with their fists, really trying to hurt him until he got away and ran off. Caroline was stunned by her own actions.
I mean, even today, my heart is beating talking about it because, yeah, I'm not a violent person and I've never done this.
How does a petite college student go from having a nice time to beating up a guy in a Halloween costume?
It's in every single one of us. We have urges to behave aggressively, we get angry, we get upset.
But most of us don't act violently most of the time. The reason Caroline remembers that story so well is because it was totally out of the ordinary for her. So what's the difference between people who keep a tight lid on any violent urges and others who don't? What turns rage into action, anger into lashing out, and hatred into murder? On today's episode, a look at violence, how it starts, and where it leads. If we think of violence as a spectrum, we're going to start at the extreme end, talking about terrorist groups that will blow up buildings, derail trains, anything to bring death, suffering, and fear to as many people as possible. How are people pulled into these groups? Who's vulnerable? Scientists are trying to figure that out. Alan Yu reports.
Social scientist Vera Miranova studies terrorism. She travels to conflict zones around the world and finds people who are part of terrorist groups. She interviews them about their motives, their lives, what got them to this point. She was interviewing this one guy who was part of ISIS. And then it turns out they had something in common. They're both Russian, and they went to the same school, Moscow State University, in the computer science department.
We chose the same major, you know, we basically went to the same, we did the same path. He was like a party person in Moscow State University, you know, basically the same as, you know, I was. But then at some point he took a different decision from me. So for me, it was like coming here to study.
Vera became a visiting scholar at Harvard University. And the guy,
for him, it was, you know, going to ISIS.
He worked on drones for the militant group ISIS. And this is exactly what she studies. How do people make decisions and end up in drastically different places? Turns out this guy is from a predominantly Muslim part of Russia called Dagestan.
And he's in Moscow, you know, in a top school and having fun. But his father was like, oh, it's time for you to marry. He got him some wife from, not educated, from some village. And he was like, here you go. You have to, you know, marry and have kids and leave. And he was like, no.
He didn't want to be married. He didn't want the life his father wanted for him. So he left a month before his wife gave birth to his son to join ISIS. To Vera, this story is an example of an important point. We may think of all the people in ISIS as motivated by religious extremism, and some of them are. But for this guy, ISIS was a way out of a bad situation. For others, it's a new opportunity. Sometimes it's just about money.
I interviewed a guy, he's from one of the Central Asian republics, and he was busy robbing supermarkets in Moscow. And then he went to ISIS where he was, let's say, like financial officer of one of the armed groups. Basically, he was dealing with loot.
ISIS finances its operations in part by selling plundered art.
So, you know, if you're into money and you're like, okay, with, you know, robbing supermarket, I that's a step up because, you know, robbing supermarket in Moscow, I mean, how much money you could earn, right? But there, the loot, you know, from one operation, it could be possible a couple of million dollars.
Vera says you have to look at these decisions with a certain amount of detachment from the terrible outcomes. She studies this the same way we study why people choose to work for one company over another.
But those guys, like, produce violence.
She even found something that looked like HR documents from ISIS. It had lecture notes on how to welcome new recruits. Of course, there are deeper psychological factors and beliefs that motivate people to join violent extremist groups. That's what Mubin Sheikh looks into. He's a counter-terrorism expert. Mubin used to be an extremist himself. Eventually, he witnessed the 9/11 attacks and saw that this violence and killing was not true Islam. But before he came to that realization, he was a recruiter for violent jihadists. Mubin grew up in Toronto, going to both public school and Islamic school. As a teenager, he felt a little torn between partying with his friends and the more religious upbringing some of his relatives wanted him to have. Eventually, he went to study Islam in India and Pakistan. There, he met a group of Taliban extremists. He fired an AK-47. He was hooked. He came back to Canada and started hanging out with similar-minded people, saying that Osama bin Laden and the Taliban were right, and that Muslims should support them. Their thoughts of violence became his thoughts.
There was this Jewish synagogue that I would always look at and see, right, as we were passing by it, and think, man, you know, like, to blow this place up.
Then he started recruiting others for the cause, and he remembers one Muslim high school kid in particular. Mubin approached him and his friends during a lunch break.
I looked at him and like when I could just tell by his demeanor when he was in the standing around his friends that he kept looking at them for approval. I just picked up on that, right? Like he would look a lot at the reactions of, you know, the three other friends that were with him. And I concluded from that he was he needed validation.
The kid complained about how his Muslim parents didn't let him watch movies or hang out with his friends outside school.
And so I basically used that as a wedge to, you know, target him to promote his status with the other three. I turned to him and I was like, you know what? You know, God has protected you through your parents by not putting you running around with these non-Muslims drinking and, you know, doing drug, you know, music and girls and da 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 and that.
But now Mubin works against extremists rather than recruiting them. He says the process of radicalization can differ depending on the group and the person. But there are two things that need to be there, a grievance and an ideology. Mubin saw that one kid wanted social status, and he'd offered an extremist misreading of Islam as a means to achieve that status.
You can apply that to white supremacists. Right? You can apply that to any violent extremist. The process is the same because it is a psychological process.
Mubin used to hang out around schools to find recruits. These days, extremists can advertise their intentions on social media, and recruits self-select.
Let's let the psychologically vulnerable people find us, so there's no investment.
That's Joel Finkelstein. He is a neuroscientist. He's part of a team that studies extremism on social media. They collect data from fringe social media networks like Gab and 4chan that white supremacists and right-wing extremists use. And then they get computers to figure out what words are most commonly used together when people have very serious violent intentions. For example, the man who was charged with killing 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. He posted on a fringe social media network shortly before the attack. He named a Jewish refugee organization and said they, quote, bring invaders in that kill our people, end quote. Joel went back and tracked down this man's previous postings to see if he used some of the language he often sees extremists use, terms like white genocide. Here's Joel reading one of the posts. It includes an offensive slur we bleeped out.
March, he said, another who pretends to be white only when it suits their needs to push genocide against white.
Joel mines posts like this for information, for recurring terms and phrases that he says could signal violent intentions.
Here, for instance, right next to white genocide is white lives matter. It's okay to be white. White privilege, anti-white, and then white pride is very close to it.
Or talking about migrants as invaders. He says you can see certain patterns emerge and connections between different users, almost like a secret language.
They're signaling to each other in the ways that a cell signals to a body. And you can't really understand what the cell is doing unless you understand the way it's interfacing with the body.
Joel says right now his team is just studying these movements online. They can't predict if people will act on the threats they post online. But eventually the ultimate goal is to tell apart extremists from potentially violent extremists.
That was Alan Yu reporting. Talking about violence, digging into all of the different feelings, conditions, prejudice that can lead to it. And what we were just looking at are extreme acts and extremist violent groups. But now let's turn to the kind of violence we might see more often. Shoving somebody, punching a wall, throwing a glass across the room, blowing a fuse.
It is there. It's in every single one of us.
That's Nathan DeWall. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Kentucky. He says the reason most of us keep a lid on this urge to lash out most of the time is because of self-control and self-regulation, which we learn early on.
We learn it when we're kids. And this is why, you know, when people ask me, you know, who are the most aggressive people on the planet? It's really two-year-olds. And so two-year-olds are the most aggressive people. And I say this, you know, I have direct experience with this. I have a daughter who's 3 years old, and I have a son who is almost 2 years old. And when you look at two-year-olds, one out of every four interactions that they have involve physical aggression. That's a ton of aggression. And I mean, it's more than gang members. It's more than prison inmates. You know, what is it about two-year-olds that make them so aggressive? I mean, most of them aren't wielding weapons, and so they don't do a whole lot of damage, but they're still beating each other up quite a bit. And so the key ingredient that seems to be missing is they don't have a lot of self-regulation. If they see something and they want it, they just take it. And they don't have the ability or really the motivation to override their impulse that says, hey, it's probably not going to be appropriate if I bite my father's leg. Maybe I shouldn't do that. And instead, I should say, yeah, you know what? It isn't my turn to have the TV remote, for example. And so it's a humorous example, but it's true. And so we start learning these things and we start being capable of learning these things about the time that kids are normally heading to school when they're 5 or 6 years old. And it continues to progress until we're in our late 20s.
Are there people who are more likely to be more aggressive and have to work harder at keeping themselves in check?
Definitely. Definitely. The people who have to work the hardest to act in pro-social ways versus anti-social ways are people who have lived most of their lives in environments where they learned that aggression was the proper way to respond to conflict, that if they have any problem, that that's the way that they solve it. And so you see kids who grow up in what we call adverse environments where their parents are beating each other up, where the parents are beating the children up. And this is simply the accepted way of acting. And you place that child in a school setting, for example, and that is that learning history that that child has. And so that's why oftentimes having an adverse environment in which you're raised, that is one of the most potent predictors of later aggressive actions.
Nathan says people can still learn to control their emotions and behavior, but it's especially difficult if they remain in a violent environment. But what about people who are usually good at self-regulation?
Honestly, what I think is the most interesting part of this conversation is this very thing. Why is it that people who seem to have it all together sometimes lash out? And I think one big reason is because they get really mentally fatigued. And so our motivation and our ability to control our impulses, eventually we need to rest and we get fatigued. And sometimes when we get stressed out, when we get tired, that is when we do many of the things that we regret the most, whether it's overeating or whether it's lashing out at other people. So oftentimes when people talk to me about these things and they'll say, you know, I never thought that I would do this sort of stuff. I often say, you know, when was the last time that you had a full night's sleep? Are you eating on a regular basis? Were you really hungry?
So if I'm really tired, really hungry, maybe I'm sweating and it's too hot and somebody is just irritating the heck out of me, that could be a situation where everything just boils over.
Exactly. And honestly, the best thing that I would recommend doing in that situation is simply leaving, because you've got, if you can, you've got all of these factors that are piling up on one after the other that are essentially, what they're doing is they're adding fuel to this flame that is about to become ignited. And all that you have to do is just find a way to leave, regroup yourself, energize yourself in some way, distract yourself in some way. And when you return, it'll be a much different situation.
Nathan DeWall is a psychologist. He studies aggression, self-control, and human relationships at the University of Kentucky. We're talking about violence, what fuels it, and where it leads. One of the most violent situations humans can find themselves in is war, being on a battlefield. It's brutal, it's bloody, yet stories of war hook us, they draw us in. One of the earliest depictions of armed conflict we have is the Iliad, an epic Greek poem written about 2,800 years ago. Classic scholar Emily Wilson picked out a scene for us and did a dramatic reading with two of her grad students. Here, the Greeks are about to face the Trojans in battle. The god Poseidon shows up to rally two Greek soldiers.
The earthquake god who shakes the world, striking them with his scepter, filled them both with strength of will and energized their limbs, speeding their hands and feet.
And now my spirit in my chest is more stirred up for battle and for making war. My body, from fingertips to toes, is hot to fight.
My fighting force has risen up inside me. My feet are bouncing from the ground already. I am set fast on fighting frenzied Hector, the son of Priam, even on my own, in single combat.
So they talked together. And they were happy in the joy of battle, which the god put inside their hearts.
The reason the Iliad still speaks to us all of these centuries later is that it captures so many universal human truths about life, loss, love, ambitions, grief. And this joy of battle that is so vividly described here, is that something modern-day soldiers can relate to? Jad Slayman is in a unique position to ask.
I served 4 years in the Marines. When I was going through boot camp on Paris Island, I imagined war might sound a bit like this.
Go, go, go. Go, go, go.
Camp, open the radio bay.
You're on this red line.
And it did. That's a U.S. Army unit fighting the Taliban. But war also sometimes sounded like this. It also felt like that, too. It was exciting. There was a kind of esprit de corps. Maybe this sounds bad, but it was actually sort of fun. I filmed that footage after the Marines, as a civilian journalist embedded with a unit in Afghanistan. I've also reported from Syria and Iraq. The soldiers and militia I followed were sometimes scared and angry and sad, but other times they were exhilarated. If war is hell, how could it also be so fun? And what's that say about those who fight?
I'm trying to shoot a 320, man. These dudes up.
Every Marine has two birthdays. There's the day you were delivered in the hospital, and then there's 10 November 1775, the day the Marine Corps was founded. It happened in a bar called Tun Tavern in Philadelphia. And every year, that birthday is celebrated at another Philly bar, Cookies Tavern. It's more of a block party, really. Marines and Marine vets, young and old, break out their old unit t-shirts and trade war stories over cigars and beer. Lots of beer. I spot Tony right away. I'm not using his last name because he doesn't want people looking him up on Facebook. He's wearing two ribbons every veteran knows instantly. One is sought after and the other feared. He's got the combat action ribbon. It's yellow, blue, and red, given to those who face enemy fire and fight back. And he's got the Purple Heart, awarded to those injured in battle.
Do you want to tell me about the Purple Heart?
Combat patrol hit an IED, took out a couple of us out of KIA.
How you doing now?
I'm doing all right, you know, I'm like any other vet, you know, you relive it here and there.
Tony was in the infantry, a machine gunner. He deployed to Afghanistan twice. At first, he was scared.
First ride out to the patrol base, I was kind of like ducking down, hunkering down. Think like, oh, there's a sniper, you know, he's sitting there waiting for me. That happened for probably about 2-3 days, and then I kind of just kept telling myself, like, hey, listen, like, you're going to die out here, just pretty much face death if it happens, hopefully it's quick.
I ask about the first time he faced the enemy. He was 19 years old.
I thought it was firecrackers. Everybody's sitting around laughing. You hear the snaps. Until one of the older guys said, oh, yeah, somebody's shooting at you. Like, you know, get yourself together. Like, we got
to
go.
Tony started to get the hang of Afghanistan, what to do during enemy contact. He learned that those firecracker snaps were the sound of supersonic rounds passing directly overhead. He started listening for the snapping. And before long, he started looking forward to it.
I said, you kind of get used to it. You kind of start enjoying it almost. You want to go out there. You actually want to get into things. It just becomes your daily thing as opposed to sitting around doing nothing and say, let's go out there, let's get into something today.
When I was embedded with U.S. forces in Afghanistan, they would keep the air power back. If the Taliban heard a jet, they wouldn't come out and take that first shot. But the soldiers wanted them to, and so did I.
Are you hit or are you good?
No, I'm good.
Sniper.
All right, I ain't going
Holy
back.
Holy that was close.
Tony calls it a rush.
There's a lot of people, you know, you see, like, you know, there's people nowadays that are hooked on drugs, whether it be heroin, cocaine, whatever the case may be. The biggest high you can ever get is a natural adrenaline rush. Somebody trying to kill you. There's nothing that will ever come to that rush in the world.
Is there something wrong with guys like Tony, guys like me? Or is this just something that happens in war?
Oh, 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 it's a lovely war. A lovely war.
I secured a direct hit on an enemy encampment. So bodies or parts of bodies go up in the air and heard the desperate yelling of the wounded or the runaways. I had to confess to myself that it was one of the happiest moments of my life.
That's from the diary of a Belgian officer manning a trench mortar in the First World War. And here's a Royal Air Force pilot from World War II writing after downing two enemy pilots.
For the rest of that night, it was impossible to sleep. I could talk about nothing else for days after. There was nothing else. It was sweet and very intoxicating.
Historian Joanna Burke collected these and other accounts written during the World Wars and the Vietnam War. They were the basis for her book, An Intimate History of Killing. She was trying to research trauma by way of these letters and diaries, but she found something else.
What really, though, surprised me was just the amount of exhilaration that I found in these first-person accounts, in their letters home and in their diaries. I wasn't expecting to see that these men, often young men, got actually a lot of pleasure, a lot of exhilaration, a thrill out of the act of combat.
She read terrified, miserable accounts as well. The joy of combat wasn't shared by everyone on the battlefield.
Well, of course, to be exhilarated, you have to survive. You have to not be dismembered. You have to be on the winning side.
But the joy of combat was unmistakably there, time and time again. When her book was published in 1999, it caused immediate controversy.
I think there's this huge sort of taboo around not around killing, because we do it all the time, that's what our military is there for, but the taboo is actually around admitting that our side can actually get pleasure in that.
She says that taboo may have led some historians to ignore accounts of enjoying combat, in favor of more sober accounts of suffering and shell shock. But amid all the criticism, Joanna says she also got letters from combat veterans basically saying, thanks. Thanks for making it feel okay to talk about this kind of stuff.
We need to look at not only the terror, but also the exhilaration and ask ourselves, you know, why is it that our people respond differently to combat at different moments of time?
There's very little scientific research into this phenomenon, but I did find a recent study in the American Journal of Psychiatry. It examined soldiers becoming, in a way, addicted to the thrill of combat. I reached out to the lead author and found out this is still a really touchy subject. The author works for a Department of Defense health agency. She agreed to the interview, but then a public affairs officer stepped in and nixed the whole thing, refusing to explain why, only saying he, quote, wasn't at liberty. After that, the lead author told me it was too risky to talk. So with her permission, I reached out to another author on the study.
I'm a senior scientist at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. I'm a psychiatrist and also a retired colonel in the U.S. Army.
That's Charles Hogue. Walter Reed is the DOD's flagship medical center. He explained that the lead scientist had noticed something with some of the veterans she was treating for post-traumatic stress disorder. They were improving in some respects, but they also remained depressed and in a state of hyperarousal.
Physiological hyperarousal or feeling amped up.
They were tormented by their time at war, but they also missed parts of it.
So, for instance, they might have distressing nightmares related to their combat experience, but then also have exciting dreams related to combat experience. Or they might avoid thinking or talking about distressing combat experience, but then engage actively in thinking or talking about the more exciting combat experiences.
The team found patients would constantly try and recreate the feelings of combat by playing war video games, watching war documentaries, and scrolling through deployment photos. It was getting in the way of their work and social lives.
Many of these service members who we studied, they weren't really even aware until it was pointed out to them of the degree to which the number of hours that they were spent engaging in combat-related activities was negatively impacting their life.
They named this combat attachment behavior. Some spent up to 10 hours a day doing these things. The science is still emerging, but Charles says researchers do know a cocktail of feel-good, fight-or-flight-related chemicals flush the brain during combat, including one he calls a natural opiate. Whatever causes this behavior, it complicates treatment. Veterans may also feel guilt about these feelings, and Charles says that may make it harder for them to connect with health workers who don't have military or combat experience.
To the degree to which there can be better understanding of the broader picture of what it's like to go to war, it might help the service member to feel a little bit better understood.
That understanding may chip away at the dropout rates seen in PTSD treatments. About half of Afghanistan and Iraq vets leave too early. Remember Tony, the Marine from the party? We didn't talk about PTSD, but he did tell me he still misses combat. It's not running his life or anything, but he does skydive occasionally to chase those feelings. And me, I don't cover wars anymore, and I'm not jumping out of any planes. But yeah, sometimes I miss the rush and wearing armor to work.
Would you ever go back and put yourself in a situation like that again?
Anybody says they wouldn't is in a real Marine. They didn't really enjoy the Brotherhood. Is there things that I could change? I don't want to see my buddies get hurt. I don't want to see, you know, my buddies get killed, but I would do it all over again without a doubt.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about violence. When a shooting happens in a school, in a bar, in a hospital, we often ask right away if the shooter has a mental illness, because we're looking for an explanation for this behavior and for a way to perhaps prevent the next incident. Is there a connection between mental illness and gun violence? And can psychologists predict if somebody will be dangerous? Nina Feldman has this story.
A couple of months ago, Amy Barnhorst got a new patient. He was an 18-year-old high school student who'd threatened to shoot up his school. And as the medical director at the UC Davis Psychiatric Hospital in California, Amy sees this type of patient a lot. It's her job to give him a psychiatric evaluation.
His reasons for doing this were kind of unclear to me, but didn't seem delusionally based, or that he was acting out of paranoia. He just kind of seemed like he didn't really like the people he was at school with, and he was angry and bitter at them, and he didn't really seem very remorseful. And so my assessment of him was like, yes, this guy is definitely a serious potential for violence.
But for her to commit him, she had to be sure that he was dangerous because of a mental illness.
And this is something that comes up with school shooters a lot is, yeah, this guy was clearly at risk of violence, but was he mentally ill?
Amy says he just wasn't. She wouldn't say he was well. He was antisocial, entitled, and aggrieved. But those aren't things you deal with in an acute inpatient psychiatric hospital. They're more like personality traits, which maybe you could deal with in years and years of therapy. Therapy, which, by the way, someone has to sign up for. But even if she knew he was probably not mentally ill, Amy was in a bit of a catch-22.
If we do release him also, then what? You know, if this were a much lower risk situation, I probably would have sent the person out and discharged them and said, you know, you don't meet criteria. If you're wrong about a school shooter, it's really bad.
In the end, she admitted him. But he appealed his case, and a hearing officer had to decide whether or not he posed a threat because of a mental illness.
And in this case, the hearing officer said, no, I don't believe he does. And so they let him go.
If you look at the research, only about 4% of violence in this country is caused by mental illness. 4%. But despite that,
you know, particularly in the aftermath of mass shootings, we always want to know, like, why didn't the mental health system catch this?
This is Beth McGinty. She researches policy that deals with mental health and violence at Johns Hopkins.
And we think, like, what in the world? Like, how did they miss this?
But if mental illness isn't causing violence, well, then they didn't miss anything. Whatever's making this person violent, maybe it's not theirs to miss. Beth says the mental health system should not be in the business of figuring out who's going to be dangerous.
The research evidence just very clearly shows that psychiatrists are not very good at predicting violence. And it's not because they're not doing their job. It's because violent behavior is very rare overall among people with mental illness. It's hard to predict rare events.
That's not to say violence is never caused by mental illness. And when it is, it gets a lot of attention. These high-profile examples stick in people's minds.
And this is a Fox News alert. U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords of Arizona was shot outside a grocery store in Tucson.
After that shooting in 2011, gunman Jared Loughner was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Psychologists said his delusions were causing him to feel threatened and act violently. The shooters in the Aurora, Colorado movie theater and at Virginia Tech were both suffering from mental illness, too. The research shows we do need to keep guns out of the hands of people who are dangerous because of a mental illness. That does keep everyone safer. But Beth says that doesn't mean we should think of everyone with mental illness as potentially dangerous.
Linking mental illness with violence, that increases public perceptions of the dangerousness of this population. And that stigma leads to, you know, discriminatory behaviors. People don't want to hire somebody with mental illness. They don't want to have somebody with mental illness marry into their family, that sort of thing.
And still, people make these sweeping statements blaming gun violence on mental illness all the time.
The mental health is your problem here. This was a very, based on preliminary reports, very deranged individual.
It's fair to say that anybody who does this has a sickness in their minds.
I don't believe that this insane monster should have ever been able to obtain a firearm. This individual was nuts.
But Beth says she gets why we do this. We're eager for an explanation, and mental illness gives us one.
We want to be able to say, this was what the cause was, and so here are some solutions to address that cause. When there is another clearly identified cause, extremism, for example, we don't jump to this mental illness narrative.
Think about violence related to terrorism, or hate crimes, or domestic disputes. We're not so quick to blame mental illness in those cases.
And often the reality is that the causes of violent behavior are very complex. You can't sort of nail down one specific thing, and that is not very satisfying.
Back at the psych hospital in California, Amy Barnhorst gets this too. And of course, she wants to keep people safe. But she still doesn't think admitting people she knows aren't mentally ill is the way to do it.
I'm filling my 50-bed inpatient hospital with people that I'm not really able to treat. I'm making those beds unavailable for people who are actually really mentally ill and need to be here. I'm sending maybe a larger message that, yeah, send all those people over to me. I'll just put them on the inpatient unit and have them hang out there until they settle down or something changes. I'm not sure what.
This story was reported by Nina Feldman. And Nina, what I'm wondering about now is, if mental illness is not the best way to predict whether someone is going to be violent, what are some things that could help us figure that out instead?
Yeah, so what we actually know based on the evidence is that the best indicator for future violence is a history of violence. That can come in a lot of different forms. One of the really common ones is domestic abuse. In some states, laws are being passed by legislators to try to be proactive about that link between domestic abuse and gun violence. So, for example, in Pennsylvania in October, a bill was passed that makes it a lot easier to take guns away from people who have been convicted of domestic abuse. So under this new bill, someone who has a protection from abuse order out against them would have to turn any guns they own over to law enforcement right away. Some states are looking at these other types of indicators, which actually the research shows are a better test of whether somebody is going to be violent than something like, say, mental illness.
Thanks, Nina.
Thank you, Mikan.
We're talking about violence, how it starts and how it impacts us. There's a national conversation happening about police officers shooting unarmed Black men. Public health researcher David Williams says officers are more likely to use force on African Americans because of internalized bias.
One of the stereotypes about African Americans is that they are violent and dangerous.
David teaches and researches at Harvard.
Research finds that, and they've done this in laboratory-based studies, showing a white male taking his wallet out of his pocket and a Black male taking his wallet out of his pocket, police officers and the general public are more likely to see the Black male taking a gun out of the pocket. The Black and white male in this test are doing exactly the same thing, engaging in exactly the same action in the same amount of time. But that's an example of how what built into our subconscious, based on how we were raised, shapes how we respond, especially in a high-pressure situation where you need to make a quick judgment of, is this a dangerous situation or not?
David is also interested in the broader health impact of police violence. He says it has created an atmosphere of fear, of being pulled over, of police, and he told me how this affected one of his friends.
He was a successful businessman, but he was a young African-American male. And if his wife needed him to go to the supermarket and pick up a gallon of milk, he would go first to his bedroom, put on a jacket and tie before he went out to run this simple errand. Because if for him, it was one way of minimizing the chances that he will be taken for some thug who's about to commit a crime.
This has come up in David's life, too. He says his wife is worried about him all the time and...
My two daughters were driving along the road one day in Massachusetts a few years ago, and they heard on the news, they were listening to a news station, African-American Harvard professor arrested by the police. And they pulled over because they wondered, could that be daddy? You know, and it turned out it was my colleague, Skip Gates, who got arrested by the police ultimately for entering his own apartment. They lived with it. They were immediately stressed because they thought themselves that this could be real, this could hit home.
Their dad could get hurt. Many African Americans say they worry about police violence. And then, generally, they're also more likely to become a victim of a violent crime. So I wondered about the ripple effect from all of that.
That is a source of stress. We know that in terms of the negative effects of stress on health, it's not just what you actually experience. But if you are protecting yourself, thinking about what might happen, that is a higher level of psychological, physiological vigilance that you are maintaining because of your perception of the environment is dangerous. I'll tell you about a body of research. It's what's called an ambulatory blood pressure study. You take Blacks and whites who don't have hypertension, and you hook them up to a little device that takes their blood pressure levels at random intervals over the course of the day and night. They wait while they sleep. And they found among these young, healthy African-Americans and whites, there were no racial differences in blood pressure during the day. But at night, when Blacks and whites were sleeping, Blacks maintained higher levels of blood pressure even while they're sleeping. What was happening is, for everyone, when you fall asleep, your blood pressure declines. blacks have a decline, but it's a smaller decline than whites. It's almost as if the environment is that dangerous that you have to sleep with one eye open. You cannot ever fully relax.
David and some of his colleagues recently studied mental health in places where a police shooting has happened.
And what we were able to document was that a police shooting of an unarmed African-American male leads to more mental health problems, not just for his family and friends who knew him, but for the entire black population in that state for up to 3 months after the event. So it illustrates that this negative experience that has received publicity is adversely affecting the mental health of the entire black population who lived in that state in which that police shooting occurred.
That's David Williams. He's a public health researcher and a professor at Harvard University. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about violence. Alfred Marshall is a longtime community organizer in New Orleans. For years, his vision for curbing violence in the city has been to address economic inequalities, to improve working and housing conditions for people in his community. Mara Laser brings us Alfred's story.
We at war, and somebody gonna win and somebody gonna lose. At war, there's casualties.
People need a living wage. When someone is released from prison, they need a job and a place to live. Alfred says the city hasn't responded to these basic needs, and that's left poor people desperate and left to do desperate things. These are the casualties Alfred's talking about.
And my job is to, just keep restoring hope in people, right? Because they're losing it. They're losing faith in the system.
In 2013, Alfred was leading a meeting. Everyone in New Orleans calls him Mr. Alfred. He was talking about the cycle of violence in the city.
It's a Tuesday night. It's my birthday. I'm holding a meeting at the office, and I'm speaking to the room, telling them about, de-escalating and no retaliation. I get a phone call. I didn't answer the call, because I'm in the meeting most of the meeting. And after not answering, somebody called the office, somebody opened the door and said, you need to answer your phone. And in doing so, I find out that my son was just shot. And immediately I rushed out and go to the scene.
His son, Sadiqi Saheed Naver, was found slumped over the wheel of his car. He was driving downtown on Claiborne Avenue, just a few blocks from the Superdome, around 7 p.m. He was 24 years old.
He wasn't in the midst of all that craziness that was happening. He was the one that was trying to glue everything together. And to lose him to violence was a tragedy for me. And it's sad to see that I experienced that violence by losing my baby boy to the streets. But what is the mindset of the young man who killed my son? What's his reason? Know what he said? He said, I just want to make people mad. So all the stuff that I was teaching in that room that night about, you got to de-escalate and all that. No, I wasn't ready to de-escalate. I want to retaliate. In that moment, I was retaliatory. Do what we have to do.
In his experience in New Orleans, involving the police can actually be more dangerous for him. Alfred says that's the way a lot of people in his community think.
What's the sense of me telling the police department what happened? People feel like they can serve their own justice. They get more justification if they do it themselves. Right? This is a street code. I don't need them to come take care of my business. For what? Two systems that's working out here. There's your system and my system. That there's, there's a street justice and there's your justice. How do you get help for people that's been traumatized?
There is some money going towards city-sponsored prevention efforts, but Alfred says these often miss the point.
Midnight basketball, that ain't what we need. Not real education, what our children need. We know how to deal with conflict. We know what we need after conflict. You can't give me a basketball and this thing that's going to change the rules of what's happening on the street.
The city does have some restorative justice programs that send somebody out to the scene of a crime, but for Alfred, this feels too late.
After somebody have been killed, why would you wait after? After somebody has killed, then you go in and try to restore justice. That ain't no restorative justice.
He knew he did not want to perpetuate violence, and he knew he needed support. His preferred violence prevention strategy involves counselors.
The reason why people retaliate is because they don't have counseling available. Yeah, I waved a white flag up. I had to learn conflict resolution.
Alfred knew the family of the guy that murdered his son, but he worried about what would happen to him if he talked to the police. Testifying can make you a target.
Because once I say, okay, I know who did it, then they're going to say, well, who? Then they put it down, then they want you to come testify. Well, you just ruined me. I'm you separated from my family. Now I'm in hiding. And how long are you going to keep me in hiding? Not very long.
In his son's case, Alfred says he felt like he had to resolve things himself.
I had to go to the guy's parent and say, look, it happened. It's over. How do we rebuild our lives together and build ourselves back up? And, you know, I mean, I think when you talk about safety, you got to talk about opportunities. You know, without opportunities, you will never be safe in a city where that's a city that's growing and thriving and transforming. And a certain people are locked out. So you creating a system of violence when you don't give opportunities to people who have been here.
Alfred continues to fight for core system changes that give people the chance at a decent life. He says creating opportunities for people is the only way to slow down the violence and the tragedies.
Somebody hits you, you hit them back. I cry, you cry. But who win? Nobody don't win that.
That's New Orleans community activist Alfred Marshall. Mara Laser produced this story with Natalie Yarn. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tong, and Jad Slayman. Julian Harris is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern, the associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski, the producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.